Winter can be a wonderful time to see wildlife, and for some of the best viewing, you don't even have to get cold. This hour, Bird Feeding 101. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease will be here today. We'll talk about attracting winter birds to your feeder. We'll find out about common species, what to feed them, and how best to see them. We'll also talk about the possible environmental impact of feeding birds, both positive and negative, and the economic impact of this incredibly popular hobby. You're welcome to call with your stories and your questions. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Winter is a wonderful time to see wildlife in many different ways, in many different places. And for those who don't really like to get out into the cold, you too can commune with nature from the warmth of your home. This hour, Bird Feeding 101. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. It's good to be back on the air and in the studio, so it's good.
All right. Well, and you are a bird feeder from way back. This is something that you really enjoy.
Yeah. I think like a lot of Iowans, a lot of Americans, we just enjoy having the birds up close and personal. And it's a way of getting to see them. And this is what I think the first thing we need to understand is that bird feeding, a lot of us think, I think sometimes, oh, we're doing it for the birds. No, we're really doing it for us. We're bringing them up close and personal so that we can watch them. Birds would probably do, the research shows that the birds would probably do just fine, for the most part, without our help. There's a little bit of research that shows that they come through the winter. Bird feeder birds come through the winter in a little better condition, maybe have slightly higher clutches of eggs in the spring. But basically, that's all there is to it. They would survive just fine on their own. But we like to bring them up close and personal, and I think that that's a good thing. I think the closer people feel to wildlife species, and certainly in a time and place where we are increasingly estranged from the wild, it's a very good thing, I think, for people to feel some responsibility, or at least get to bring them up close and personal and see what they're doing.
Well, and it's one thing to go out on a hike and to see birds and,
sure,
and to commune with nature, which is wonderful. But I think one of the exciting things about bird feeders is it's a longitudinal study. You get to observe the same birds day after day, or as the season changes, you see different birds, but you really do invest time in observing them.
Yeah, and you get to see not only their behaviors, but you get to see their interactions, their, as you say, how they change over time, and you suddenly realize, oh, gee, there's a seasonality to this, there's a phenology to this, the certain things that happened at certain times. The goldfinches that we're seeing now are very different than the goldfinches we saw even a month ago. They still had a lot of yellow on them, that bright bright yellow on them, and a month or so ago, and now they're pretty drab. I wonder if the yellow ones have left and these have moved in. No, these have they've changed their plumage. So it's fascinating to watch those changes through the season.
And this is a big deal. A lot of people do this, right?
Yeah, yeah. There are something like 56, this is according, there's a survey done every 5 to 7 years by the Census Bureau and the National, or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and it's called the National Survey of Hunting, Fishing, and Wildlife-Related Activities. And bird feeding has been, and they've done this now for, 35, 40 years now. And bird feeding is done by 56 million Americans. That's our latest, the latest survey, which was a few years ago now. And in Iowa, you know, you think that Iowans we're pretty conservative. We don't partake in this much, but about a quarter of the population does. So we have over 685,000 Iowans that we know of actually participate in bird feeding. It's pretty amazing.
Wow, such a big industry. Who knew?
Yeah, exactly. And we spend just a fair bit of pocket change on it. In fact,
are you going to share your personal finances?
I could. We're well above the average, I would say, because we have out around our house, and we have them on all sides of our house. We have 16 to 20 feeders during the winter of different kinds and different levels and different feed, and we do that for a number of reasons. One, it's for us, but we know that birds like to feed in different places at different levels, and so we put out a variety of different kinds of feeders to attract different ones. So we spend, I think, the average in Iowa for wildlife watching. This includes bird watching and going out trips to watch deer or whatever. Iowans spend an average of $245 per person. Americans spend over $38.4 billion with a B on wildlife watching. Now, that includes trips, of course, but just bird watching, Iowans, believe this or not, how much would you guess that Iowans spend on just the bird seed? Just the bird seed, not the feeders, not traveling anywhere, but just the bird seed. What would you guess?
Oh my gosh, I have no idea, Jim. You're just going to have to tell me.
$45 million.
$45 million.
This is big business, folks. Just on bird seed, it is just amazing. And $2.6 billion nationally, billion with a B, nationally, on bird seed.
Wow.
It's big business, and it's why so many places sell bird seed, because it is a very, very popular activity. So it has huge economic impacts for us, as in addition to say nothing of the pleasure that it brings us and the feed that birds utilize.
So clearly, right now we're talking with many individuals who are already experts at feeding birds, because the numbers are definitely in our favor.
Right.
If this is something that you really enjoy, we'd love to hear why you think it's so important, why you do it. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Of course, you can also ask questions and tell us about some of the rarest spottings you've had in your backyard bird feeder. But Jim, let's say somebody wants to get started.
Right.
What's the best way to get going?
Well, I'd say, first of all, you have to look at your yard and say, where am I going to see them regularly? Where is the best place to put a feeder? If I'm going to have, start with one, obviously. If I'm going to put a single feeder out, where's the best place? Well, the best place would be on the side of the house that you can see them most often. It might be outside your breakfast nook or outside your living room. It could be outside your office if that's where you spend your day. So you need to decide, where's the best window for me to watch the activity at this feeder? The second consideration is, are there shrubs or trees nearby? I've had people call me in the past that have said, gee, I've got this feeder and I buy the most expensive feed and I don't have any birds. And I say, well, where's the nearest tree? Well, we don't have any trees in our yard. And I go, okay, where's the nearest shrub? We don't have any shrubs either. Well, bingo. You know, they have to feel safe in coming to that feeder. And so usually something within 6 to 10 feet from the feeder, trees or shrubs of some some kind are really important. If you don't have those, perhaps you can find a discarded Christmas tree or something and stand it up out there with a tree stand or something, or even laying it down on the ground, having something around that they can feel safe, that they can stage from. They fly to the shrub and then they'll go to the feeder. So looking at those kinds
and
of things
plant
in your
some
yard.
Shrubs for
right,
next
yeah.
year. Right,
yeah. Well, that would be the next thing, of course. It's a little too late this year. But then you say, well, what do I put in it? The number one feed that will feed the widest variety of birds, of species, because not all species have the same as bird feeders know, of course. Birds have different sizes of bills and different abilities to open seeds. But the number one seed that attracts the widest variety of birds and is the highest value to them is the black oil sunflower seed. This is not the ones that you buy to, or the ball players buy to spit out during the ball games. Those are the big striped sunflower seeds. But the black oil sunflower seed, they're a little smaller. They're called black oil because they are very high in oils and fats, very highly digestible. Now, birds do have to be able to get through the shell on the outside to get to the valuable seed on the inside. And they do that in various ways. Cardinals and some of the sparrows that have very cone-shaped, very strong bills are able to just simply put it in their mouth, squeeze down. If you've ever been pinched by a cardinal, you know how strong their beaks are. Man, they hurt. There's no question. And they will actually just break open that shell, just like a nutcracker, really, really easily, and take out the inside, spit out the shell out the other side of their beak. Other birds, though, with small beaks, like, for example, a black-capped chickadee, they have a tiny bill, and you say, well, how are they going to get it? Well, you'll find what they do is that they fly to the feeder, grab a seed, fly up to a tree, wedge it between their feet or in the bark of the tree, and whack at it with their bill until they break it open. So the little hammer. And if you've ever handled a black-capped chickadee, if you're a bird bander, you know how they'll sit and kind of peck at your finger. And they don't hurt near as much as a cardinal does. So.
I will take your word for that as well.
So they're black oil sunflower seed, I think, is the thing to start with.
All right. Of course, we also see the thistle seed. That's something that, of course, people love to attract goldfinches, particularly here
right.
in Iowa. So if there's a particular species that you want to attract, I mean, do you get pretty specific with your different feeders?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. That's why we put out different kinds of seed in different locations. A lot of birds feed at different levels. For example, juncos, which are actually a boreal forest bird, they nest up across northern Minnesota and across Canada in the boreal forest, but they come down here in the wintertime because we have such balmy temperatures compared to up there, and we don't generally have as much snow, so that they will feed on the ground. So you need to have some feed on the ground as well.
All right, well, we'll talk more in just a moment. With me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about bird feeding today. The how, the why, the economics, and we'll talk about the environmental impact of bird feeding as well as the hour goes on. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking about bird feeding, which is a huge hobby, a whole lot of fun, big business as well. And we were talking just before the break about attracting different species. So if you have a favorite species, you want to do your research, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you want to look at what they prefer. And again, birds that have very tiny bills are going to prefer smaller seed. And one of the most popular ones that is out there is this Niger thistle seed. It's a tiny black seed that comes from a actually a non-native thistle called the Niger thistle. It was discovered a number of years ago now. I don't know how long it's been around, but it got quite a long time on a commercial basis. And it can be fed in a variety of ways. Because it's a small seed, you need small openings for it, or it would just sort of pour out of the feeder. So you'll see some of these tube feeders that have little perches along them and a tiny little slit in the opening. That allows birds with small bills, things like goldfinches and chickadees and nuthatches, to reach inside that little slot and pull out a seed or two at a time. There are also a variety of things, these sort of net socks that are fine netting, not onion bag netting, that's too large, but very fine netting. You can hang those up. They're quite simple and will last a number of years. They eventually sort of decay by use and by sunlight, working on the material a little bit, but they do last quite a long time. Lots and lots of, this is a whole nother area of bird feeding. There are lots of folks out there who are into the woodworking aspect of bird feeding and will build lots and lots of different feeders. All you have to do is go into your local farm store or a bird feeding store. Usually a lot of farm co-ops are now supplying bird seed. Many of them also carry bird feeders, made by local folks. This is a whole area of bird feeding that has really gone crazy with different kinds of woods and different styles for different birds. So it's quite an industry. But you want to do your research about what birds you're trying to attract and recognize that you may get some things that you didn't expect or you didn't even want. You might, for example, attract starlings or a lot of house sparrows, that sort of thing. Maybe if you live in an area where there starlings and house sparrows are nest readily, you may get mainly house sparrows and starlings. And they're kind of aggressive at a feeder. They will kind of chase off other birds, and that may be frustrating to you. And that can happen.
And you may also attract some predators.
Yeah, you may. And after all, this is a bird feeder, and predators are birds. The two most common, and we have around our house, we have a fairly large predator. It's quite fun to watch him, actually. I find it fun. My wife doesn't always agree. we have a Cooper's hawk. The two hawks that are bird eaters generally are Cooper's hawks and sharp-shinned hawks, and both of them are often attracted to bird feeders because, gee whiz, the picking is easy.
Right.
and what our Cooper's has learned to do is to sort of fly through once and drive birds from the feeders in panic. And one of them will run into a window or something like that, and then he can easily, go and feast. And it's disturbing sometimes, but if you look at it as the fact that they have to make a living as well, and they're simply using what you have provided for them, it's quite fascinating to watch them.
We have a lot of people on the line, so you say embrace the hawks.
Sure, absolutely.
Right. We have a lot of people with questions for you. You can join the conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Randy in Iowa County has a suggestion for us. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, the local locker, when they butcher beef, there's beef fat or suet.
Oh, you bet. Yeah.
That's... You can kind of gourmet it up to whatever you want to stick in.
Yeah.
The little seeds or whatever.
Yeah, that's
Most
great.
Most times they don't charge much for the lard because it's, it was probably fed too much grain and it got a little on the fat side.
Right. Yeah, that's a great suggestion, Randy, and that's one of the feeds that will attract actually an amazing number of birds. And you can take that, you can feed that suet just as it comes out. This is usually back fat and kidney fat and things like that that come off of an animal that's butchered, And some lockers have figured out that this is a valuable commodity and have charged more than others. But other lockers have said, no, it's fine. It's an awful product. O-F-F-A-L.
Right.
And we'll let it go pretty, it used to be free, but it's no longer free. But most of them will sell it in large chunks. And you can put that in a net bag, like an old onion bag, hang it up in a tree, again, where you can see it, and you'd be amazed at the number of birds that come there. You can also, as you suggest, Randy, combine it with some other things. Some people put seed on it from other kinds of bird seed, peanuts and black oil sunflower seed, maybe some white proso millet, all kinds of things. Or they'll melt it down and mix it with those and some dried fruits as well. So there are all kinds of ways to do this. And if you go to a bird feeding store, you'll see, gee whiz, where'd all these suets come from? I thought fat was fat. And they put lots of other things with it to attract them. And what you'll attract are some of the woodpeckers, downy woodpeckers, hairy woodpeckers, red-bellied woodpeckers, occasionally a flicker, depending on where you are in the state of Iowa and what time of the year it is. You'll also attract nuthatches and chickadees. A lot of things will be attracted to that fat because it is highly digestible and gives them a lot of energy. When we think about birds in the winter in Iowa, they have to get through not only the day, but the nights. And in order to do that, they have to take in enough food during the day, and during the night they convert that food energy, that chemical energy, into heat energy. And they do that by shivering. Their muscles are shivering underneath. That creates heat to keep their body temperature up a little bit.
Go
ahead.
No, go. Finish that thought.
Okay. Well, so that what the fat does and what the various feeds are, there are good feeds and there are bad feeds. The good feeds allow them to convert that chemical energy to heat energy readily. So high digestibility and high usability is really important.
With suet, I can imagine that there are other creatures that would be very attracted to that. So what kind of precautions do you take to make sure you're also not feeding possums and raccoons, et cetera?
Well, and some people don't mind that, so they put it where where the possums and skunks and raccoons can get to it. But often if you hang it out from a branch instead of right up against the trunk of a tree, is a good idea to keep the mammals away from that. If we were farther north, I might say, well, you might attract some bears, you might attract some fishers, martens, that sort of thing. But in Iowa, we're mostly talking about raccoons, possums, and skunks. And so if you hang it out on the end of a branch or partway out on that branch, it tends to keep those critters away.
Well, and I think it's important to make sure that people understand. I remember my grandfather was a bird feeder, and mm-hmm. he had his ideas about good birds and bad birds.
Yes.
And there was a constant war going on against the bad birds. But, I mean, if you're going to put food out, there are all kinds of critters that are going to come for that.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You may not always get what you want. I think there was a Rolling Stones song for that.
I've heard it a few times.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Jill is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jill.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What would you like to share?
Okay. So when I was teaching, I took a mystery bag into classrooms, K-6, and kids really surprised me by, if they knew the line of questioning of like 50 questions and how to narrow down what's in the bag, still many of them would absolutely get stuck when they'd get it down to like a local animal. And I had a feather in my bag. I was amazed how long it took some kids until they'd played the game with me.
Ah, really? Yeah.
You know, local animals, birds. So that was always an eye-opener to me. So I love to connect kids and adults. And now that I'm retired, I have a lot of feeders still, but I post online find the cardinal kind of photographs,
mm-hmm.
and adults are going crazy for that, and because they look at my yard photo, you know, and I'll say like find the two, you know, whatever, and they're like you should sell these, you should write a book. It's just like the fun of seeing wildlife, I think, really helps connect people to that.
That's great, and
and I think
You've taught them how to
the environment.
You've taught them how to form a search image, right? When they look at a scene and find that that particular bird or mammal in the scene. That's a great idea.
Right, and I'll hear from people like, you know, inner city Detroit, like, oh, this is so much fun. You know, it's kind of really surprising to me. And the other comment I wanted to make is that we saw a gold cardinal. And that's our rarest bird so far.
A gold cardinal. When you say gold,
right? They're very.
Yeah, describe yeah, kind of gold. a blonde one.
Pretty gold. And so we got a picture. We looked it up, and it's very rare. It's a mutant, basically.
Right. Yeah. It's the same species, and a lot of birds you'll see. This happens more often in mammals. We think of what's called melanism or albinism, being melanism is all dark colored. Or albinism is a lack of pigment in hair, but we see that occasionally in birds. It's not as common in birds,
right?
But it does happen. So and actually, color of the either the fur or the feathers is one of the easier things to change. So it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well,
hey, thank
Jill,
you. For all your-
Thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Wilbur's up next in Sioux City. Hi, Wilbur.
Hi, guys. I just want to tell you about my little setup here. I've got three feeders out there. The first one is for the finch, and it's a Niger
thistle seed. Right.
Uh-huh. And they just go nuts for that.
So excuse me, Wilbur, is this a mix then of both the Niger thistle seed and sunflower hearts then?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, good. That's a great feed. Great feed.
Yeah, they go wild for that.
Yeah.
And the middle feeder is just some general smaller seeds, millet and, a few sunflowers and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then my other one is total sunflowers. And then... I put a little basket out there, and I drop in a dozen peanuts every morning. And these blue jays go crazy. I mean, they just you can set your watch by them, those guys. So what I have is a 6-inch stovepipe around my shepherd's hooks that I hang my feeders on to keep the squirrels from climbing up there.
Right.
And it'll work on the possums and raccoons and stuff because they can't get their claws into that stainless steel.
Right. Oh, that's great.
And then the other thing, of course, is water. I keep fresh water out there every day, and they all go to the water as well.
That's
and
right.
It helps through the winter.
That's
the one
fantastic.
Thing I wanted to ask you, yeah. I'm sorry. The one thing I wanted to ask you real quick was about the nuthatch. They seem to just swoop in there, grab a sunflower, take off. Is that... typical behavior?
Yeah, it is. And that's you mentioned several things that I want to talk about. One is the nuthatch. The nuthatch have a long pointed bill. And with long pointed bills, they don't have a lot of downward pressure. They're not able to simply crack that seed. And what nuthatches will do, even with shelled peanuts, they will fly in, as you mentioned, grab a single seed, and then fly up to a nearby tree. And they'll wedge that seed into the branch or into the bark or the branch of the tree. And sometimes they'll find a little imperfection in the bark or an old kind of a knot hole that's in there. They'll wedge that in there and then whack it just like a chickadee does, whack it with their bill to kind of open it or to make it and break it into smaller pieces, and then they'll consume it. It's quite an interesting behavior, and the way you described it is exactly what they do, and it's absolutely normal for nuthatches. Now, do you have white-breasted nuthatches, or do you also get another boreal forest bird, a northern bird that comes down in the winter called the red-breasted nuthatch? Have you seen those?
I have not seen those, just the white-breasted.
Okay. The red-breasted, watch for them, because being around Sioux City, you should you may get some during the winter. They're a little smaller, about an inch smaller than the white-breasted nuthatch, making them a total of maybe 4 inches long. And they do have a sort of, I wouldn't call it bright red, but it's a more of a rusty-colored breast. And they have this sort of racing stripe through their eye. I call it a racing stripe. And they're really a beautiful little bird, but they behave just like the white-breasted nuthatches do. They'll come down the bark head first, down a tree trunk head first often, but they're a little bit smaller and a little bit faster even than the white-breasted nuthatches. So watch for those. They're really cool.
Absolutely. I'll do that.
Yeah, thanks.
You guys are real delight. Thank you so much.
That's great.
Thanks for your call, Wilbur. We've got a question. Speaking of bird bats, George is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, George.
Hi.
What's your question?
I did want to mention bird bats and how to keep them from freezing over in the wintertime.
Okay.
Most of the garden stores do sell a circular heating pad, circular foil pad.
Sure.
That is designed to keep the water warm. And you can put those right in your bird bath, or if it doesn't, they don't fit in your bird bath, you can get a large planter at the store and put that on the planter perch,
right,
and use that as a bird bath.
That's great.
It has to be weighted down, though, you know.
Right.
But anyway, I thought I'd mention that to keep the water warm in the winter.
Yeah. Now, what some people will do is they don't want to run electricity out there. They don't have it nearby, so they'll actually put a little water in a dish every day. And if you're dedicated, you can do that. But it's certainly on cold winter days, it'll freeze in a matter of half an hour to an hour. But sometimes, if you put it out at the same time each day, the birds will learn, oh, this is when the water is open and available, and so we'll come to it. But as you said, technology has allowed us to have heated bird baths, and there are a number of things available. It's not like a jacuzzi. It just keeps the water just above freezing, so it's not like really super heated at all.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. George, thank you for your call. We'll continue our conversation talking about bird feeding this hour with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bird feeding. Jim Pease, wildlife biologist, is here with us today. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions and your observations. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to ask about bird baths for just a moment, because earlier you already said that maybe we're giving birds a little bit of an edge by feeding them and caring for them, but it's not a make or break thing.
Right.
Now, how about water? I mean, obviously, water is essential to life, but how important, how much of an impact might water with your bird feeding setup have on the birds?
Well, believe it or not, there are often places, almost always places, where birds can find enough open water to get through the winter. Birds actually reduce their sort of physiological demand for water during the winter, for fresh water, and they will extract an awful lot of moisture from the foods that they eat. But they do need some water. Some birds will actually take in snow, but others find little places where there are creeks that are part of the creek that is open, or a spring that comes from the ground. So without it, they would still find water. But what it does is a bird bath does provide a ready supply for birds, and it will attract a lot of your feeder birds to it. But it also attracts birds that will not necessarily come to your feeders for the bird seed, but they will come to the bird bath for water. Things like robins. We usually, if we look at the Christmas bird counts that are done every year by groups of bird enthusiasts around the nation, actually around the world, the Christmas bird counts show that we almost always have robins, and actually an incredible number of robins that overwinter in the state. And one of the things that they will be attracted to is open water. They won't come to your feeders for any of the bird seeds that we've talked about, but they will come to the bird bath. So will things like cedar waxwings. Cedar waxwings are one of my favorite birds. They're beautiful, small bird that eat a lot of insects. They'll hawk over the river, grabbing insects out of the air during the summertime to feed their young. They need lots of protein to raise those little birds up, and but they'll also eat a lot of fruit. So both in the wintertime, both the robins and the cedar waxwings are eating some of the dried fruit on some of the trees and shrubs where the fruit persists. And they will also then, they won't eat other seeds, but they will come to your bird bath. So the bird baths attract birds that you wouldn't see otherwise.
Now, is there a downside to feeding birds? Can there be a negative environmental impact?
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you concentrate wildlife in any form, be it deer or raccoons or mountain lions or birds, you have the potential for a number of things. We talked about, for example, earlier the fact that predators learn where they're going to be successful. It's pretty simple. They're most successful where the birds are most concentrated. And so you will attract some predators that you might not otherwise. Those predators, of course, are going to eat anyway. So they'll figure out a way, but you just... by concentrating the birds around your feeders, you will occasionally have a predatory bird, a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk that will come in and take a bird. Most often, I've offered them up all the starlings and house sparrows that they want, you know, but they're not that selective. They'll take whatever they can get. You will attract that. The other downside is whenever you concentrate wildlife, you run the potential for easy disease spread. Because we're mainly feeding in the winter, although not exclusively in the winter, and we can talk about that if you want, whenever you have close contact among birds, that disease can spread very quickly. And a recent example, and we still see a little bit of this in different places in the state, there's a bird called the house finch, which was native to the U.S., but not to Iowa. It was a western U.S. species, native out there. Got taken to New York in 1948 as a cage bird, and of course some escaped somehow. And they gradually built up in population, began to spread across the eastern U.S. from the East Coast to the Rocky Mountains, where they were not native, and they very quickly spread across Iowa, and I think it was about 1993, and we began seeing them early in the winter of, early in the year in 1993, and by the end of the year, they were across the whole state. Mm. And they do compete fairly successfully with house sparrows. So they tend to be more of an urban bird, not entirely, but a little bit more of an urban bird. But what happens is they were particularly subject to an eye encrustation disease where they would, it's called a mycoplasma, and this disease would encrust over there, form a crust over an eye, and they would go blind. And, of course, when you can't see, you don't live very long in the bird world. And one or both eyes. And so this spread pretty rapidly among, almost as rapidly as the birds spread across the eastern part of the U.S., spread rapidly and really thinned out the numbers of house finches. So we see this disease occasionally. It doesn't seem to get into other species of birds, at least not yet. But it's an example of what can happen when you concentrate species, any species, around a food source or whatever. The chances of a disease spreading certainly increase. There haven't been other diseases that have been particularly bad, particularly if people clean their feeders, and in the springtime, when the there's always waste feed on the ground underneath, when that starts, if the frost goes out of the ground and that actually starts to be available again, That is sort of halfway composted, and there can be a disease, salmonella. The bacteria kind of build up in that sort of mass of feed underneath, and birds can die from that readily too. So you want to clean up that feed underneath your feeders as early in the spring as you can get out there to avoid that.
All right. And speaking of invasive species, this is an interesting note from Heather. She says, our most unusual yard visitor was a cockatiel at the feeder. He is now comfortably in a roost in our family room. And she's wondering if you can speak to how many non-native birds are in Iowa.
Well, the non-natives primarily in Iowa are certainly house sparrows, pigeons and starlings. Those are the probably most common non-natives. For there to be what are normally cage birds, and this involves everything from the occasional budgie bird or parakeet to the cockatiel, perhaps a parrot or two that escapes. Those are rare, and they usually, because they're almost all tropical birds, they will not survive the winter, so our winters are tough enough that most of those species cannot survive on their own. And the feeders that we would provide, probably it's a matter of having the downy feathers that allow them to withstand the cold, and those guys would have a very tough time of it. So while they're occasionally, we do see that, it's usually more in the spring, summer, early fall time than in the winter.
Here's a message from Bill in Carlisle. He said, I saw a male bluebird in my tree this morning. I live southeast of Carlisle. I've never seen bluebirds this late in the year. Are they still migrating, or do some of them stay for the winter?
Great question. And yes, they do. We again, on the Christmas bird counts, we usually see different parts of the state bluebirds that have overwintered here. And you say, my golly, what do they eat? Well, they'll find certainly some worms and a few insects here and there. They will eat some seed, usually not at the feeders, but occasionally they will. But they seem to find enough. And you say, well, how do they keep warm? Well, what they'll do is they will go into any birdhouses you might have up, or cavities, natural cavities in trees, often with other groups of bluebirds, and will overwinter, believe it or not. Actually, in a they do lower at night. They do lower their body temperatures. They go into a sort of a torpor. It's not hibernation, but it's a torpor, and so they reduce their food demand. So,
let's go back to the phones. Jim is on the line in Jefferson. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Hey, I did want to mention a few things. I started off just thinking about our nature's window, which is, it's like a baby monitor.
Listen to the birds when you're inside?
Yeah, we have a microphone outside. My wife is a huge bird feeder, and not ostrich-wise, but she feeds lots. But anyway, we listen to the birds all winter. You know, when they come around and it's been snowing, it's really great to sit in there and get some outdoors in there.
That's great. What do you think they're saying?
Probably nice things about my wife.
Ah, there we go. Good. All right. Good answer.
And about the other animals, like squirrels, we enjoy those. My wife's dad used to, he's got to be real old, and he could still crack walnuts and pick them, and he was doing tons of them from Peyton, Iowa. Just, they're all over. And
oh, that's
and
great.
He'd give us walnuts, and we told him we can't use them. We're gonna have to feed them the birds, and he said, that's fine, I don't care, I just enjoy it. Anyway, started getting a lot of squirrels, and I thought, well, I saw a guy feed a squirrel before, and so I started being out there and chucking a little piece of walnut to those guys, and pretty soon I was feeding him by hand.
Oh, which, sure.
Yeah, that was pretty special feeling for me anyway.
You bet.
But you do have birds that fly into the windows, and we try and minimize that, you know, put the water far away from the windows and the doors, and And then on our porch, we hung a big piece of fiberglass screen on the outside so that, I mean, we're picking up all kinds of beautiful birds outside, and that hurts. So they just run into that now, and it doesn't
hurt. That's great. You know, that's a good suggestion. I want to talk about that because what happens sometimes is the birds fly from your feeders, and they don't understand what glass is. They'll see the reflection of trees in your window, like a mirror, and they think it's more trees. So they'll fly right into it, and, of course, they get their necks broken or they get a brain hemorrhage. All kinds of things happen to them. So to avoid that, there are a variety of things you can do. The silhouettes on the windows, is really mixed reviews on whether that helps or not, silhouettes of hawks, that sort of thing. But what a lot of people are beginning to do is put it, like you said. Now, you said you use what kind of screening?
Fiberglass. It's not the metal screen.
Right, okay. What some people do is take regular bird netting that you can buy at any garden store to put over fruit trees to keep the birds from getting at the fruit, and they'll stretch that from, say, from the overhang of the house, from the soffits, all the way down out away from the window and attach it to the ground below so that if a bird hits it and it's taut, just as your fiberglass screening is, so that if they hit that, they simply bounce off and they don't hit the window. So those kinds of solutions are really important. Different times of the day seem to be worse than others for birds hitting the windows. It depends on the reflection of the sun off the windows. So,
that's something a lot of people have problems with.
Yeah, exactly. And so this just buying this bird netting or screening, like you were saying, is a good way to prevent some of that.
Now, we have this question from Scott in Windsor Heights. He says, it seems that many people feed only in the wintertime or cold seasons. What are the pros and cons to feeding all year long?
Yeah, pros and cons are the con is that if you feed through the summer, you're going to have lots of other critters which will also feed, especially ground squirrels and chipmunks, and you tend to increase the size of those small mammal populations, and you'll have more holes and more damage from them and that sort of thing. So what I recommend is not feeding the large seeds. Stop feeding the peanuts and the black whale sunflower seed in the summer. If you want to continue feed the goldfinches, that sort of thing, then stick with that mix of either Niger thistle with the sunflower hearts, which is often called finch feed. You can feed those small seeds. And then switch also to feeding hummingbirds during the summer with a 4-to-1 mix of water to sugar. You can put that out in feeders for the hummingbirds. Some people even choose during the summertime to feed the bluebirds and some of the others by putting out, they'll raise their own wax worms, and it's great. It's amazing. And we'll put them out in a little dish, and the bluebirds come and pick them up to feed their young with. So there's all kinds of feeding available. And again, I think it's a very positive thing. It brings people close to wildlife and wildlife close to people. I think we need more of that, not less of that. So.
Now, you mentioned just in passing the backyard bird count that happens always around the holiday season.
Right. Yeah.
So you can also be a part of keeping track of species as a bird feeder and a bird watcher, right?
Yeah, exactly. Cornell Lab of Ornithology has their feeder watch program. There are local bird groups almost everywhere in the state, Audubon Society groups that have regular field trips, or they, as I say, you can get involved with Christmas bird counts with them, so that the birds at this can develop into a lifelong hobby. We didn't get into the things about how do you keep the squirrels away, but that's okay.
There are so many online resources,
there
chat
really are.
Groups to.
Yeah.
To walk you through that process.
Yes. So number
and
one.
And great communities to get involved in.
Oh, there really are. Yeah. There really are. And it's a way of involving yourself with your community, both human and non-human.
Well, Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We've been talking about bird feeding this hour, and Jim Pease will be back again next month on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The show is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Robbie Broad. You can get in touch with us anytime. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can follow us on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio or on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm there too at Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.